Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, ricksmithshow.com. So I remember, and I actually remember it like it was yesterday, July 27th, 2005. The U.S. House of Representatives, like thieves in the night, passed the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. And I remember, passed by one vote. It was a 217 to 215 vote, two no votes. You had 15 Democrats who went along with 202 Republicans to pass this monstrosity through. And look, at the time, we said, we're going to lose jobs over this. But more importantly, this is just going to be that free fall to the bottom of the barrel with working conditions. And what we've seen over the years is, as predicted, working conditions are horrible. You have the assassination of union leaders. You have the firing of people, the constant intimidation, all of this, and not surprising. But we were told this agreement was different. We were going to have strong environmental and labor protections. Well, here to talk about how that's been working out, I've asked our good friend Celeste Drake. She is the AFL-CIO's Trade and Globalization Policy Specialist. Celeste, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me, Rick. Good to be here.
So I was told, and maybe you can help me with this, I was told strong labor and environmental, the chapters were there, we're going to protect workers all across the world. How's that working out for us?
Not so well. And this is the problem. We keep hearing the same rhetoric, whether it was in the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, in the CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, in the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, which has fallen apart and the U.S. has withdrawn from. It's the same rhetoric. Strong, enforceable protections. They're going to create a level playing field. They're going to help workers. But those are talking points. The reality is you have to look. This is a contract. A trade agreement is a contract between countries. You have to look at the provisions. And those provisions they're a front. They're a sales pitch. They're an advertising slogan that allows somebody to say strong, enforceable labor protections to create a level playing field. And what they are a series of obstacles that actually say they're protecting labor rights, but really make it pretty clear that it's going to be nearly impossible to ever bring an effective case and address true labor abuses and exploitation, whether it's in the U.S. or in one of the countries that we trade with.
Right. And again, you keep hearing about, you can go to the tribunal or you could go to these panels and you can have your cases heard. You go, but who's going to bring them out? And a lot of this stuff, you see the steel workers bringing trade cases and enforcement cases. But who's going to stand up for the rights of these workers? I mean, how many, the unions in these countries are generally under attack. And I remember the push for the Colombian Free Trade Agreement. I'm going, a country where they literally take unionists up in planes and throw them out. These are the folks that we're gonna have a trade agreement with?
Absolutely. And listeners might be interested to know that each year, for the past decade or so, Guatemala and Colombia have been vying for the title of the most dangerous place in the world to be a trade unionist. You know, their per capita assassination of trade unionists for trade union activity, either one of them is at the top. And 83 trade unionists have been murdered and assassinated for their labor work since CAFTA took effect. And, you know, as you said, it's really not that long ago. It's been about a decade that CAFTA has been in effect, and there's been 83 trade unionists murdered. Unfortunately, just to show you how weak these provisions are, the U.S. government, which is the entity that has to bring the case on behalf of workers, to answer your question, told us that the murder of trade unionists is not a violation of the labor chapter in CAFTA. So it wasn't even addressed in the case that we lost.
So hold on, stop. Let me get this straight. I can't fire you. I can't intimidate you on the job. I can just kill you? That's
yes.
Okay? I can't.
That's okay.
All right. And we agreed to this?
Well, we didn't agree, right? But Congress agreed. The negotiators between the governments agreed, and then Congress agreed. And part of that is, you know, the fast-track implementation procedure where members of Congress can't say, wait, hold on a minute, stop. I'd like to trade more with Guatemala, but not under these terms. Let's fix it. they only have an opportunity to say yes or no. And in the highly charged environment that is Washington, D.C., they tend to say yes. And that's a problem with fast track. But, yeah, that's what shows you that these labor provisions, they aren't real. They're a fig leaf to provide those who want to vote for these trade agreements some cover that, look, they've strengthened the labor provisions. And certainly from NAFTA to CAFTA, they brought the chapter into the full text of the agreement. And they made the process not quite so convoluted as what you had to go through if you were going to bring a case in NAFTA, which never got to this point of creating a panel. But they also have no mandatory timelines, no mandatory enforceability. So countries can say maybe they want to enforce the labor chapter, maybe they don't. Maybe they want to act like they're going to enforce the labor chapter and then just let complaints sit forever because there's no requirement to move them. And in the end, it gets back to your question about who's doing the work here. CAFTA contains an investment chapter that has a provision called Investor-to-State Dispute Settlement, ISDS. Your trade activist listeners will be familiar with ISDS. That's where a foreign investor who invests under CAFTA, who thinks that its rights have been violated, can bring a case directly. It can go to Guatemala and say, hey, Guatemala, I'm just an investor here, but I'm going to take you to an international tribunal, and I'm going to accuse you of having violated my property rights, and we'll see who wins. Workers do not have the same right. We have to petition one of the governments in the agreement to go after another government in the agreement. And the weakness there is they can say no. And in Guatemala, they said yes, but it took them 9 years, 9 years plus, and they lost. And it wasn't a great example of the U.S. really saying to Guatemala, get your affairs in order, enforce your labor laws, protect your workers, make sure that workers can organize, because that's not what happened.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this then, because, you know, I'm sure there are people, well, just Guatemala. Why do we care about Guatemala or Honduras or El Salvador or Colombia or Costa Rica? Why do we care about any of those places?
Well, for one reason, right, it's the right thing to do. It's the U.S. government claims to be a moral actor in the world and to protect human rights violations against the vulnerable. That's what's happening. But, you know, in the context of the trade agreement, and this is where it really is relevant, if we're bringing in goods from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, whatever it is, and these goods are made under exploitative conditions, unsafe, wage theft, denial of union rights, denial of bargaining, in a fair manner, firing, killing, threatening workers for trying to join a union, that means that we in the U.S., even if we're not being assassinated for trade union activity, or even if we personally are not the victims of wage theft, all of those things that are happening in Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador, they impact the wages that we can command on our jobs. So as workers are exploited elsewhere, it means we in the U.S., are going to be paid less. We are more likely going to be exploited. It's going to be harder to form a union and bargain with our employers here. We're all sort of one big labor market. And the really interesting thing is that it's pretty hard for workers to move across borders for work, although it happens, but it's impossible for us to bargain across borders and set those workplace standards across borders. But the employers, they have it really easy. They can move and invest and either hire factories through contracting out or build their own factories wherever they want, and they do it. And they do it in ways that exploit workers and play this game of arbitrage by essentially telling workers, if you don't take a pay cut, if you don't take your wage theft and shut up, if you don't take this anti-union intimidation and shut up, that's all fine. But we're going to close down this factory and rebuild elsewhere where we can exploit workers even more. And also, by the way, probably pay lower taxes and exploit the environment even more. So it's all a game that's to the advantage of the corporations. And the problem is, it doesn't have to be this way. We can easily change that by setting up a different set of international trade rules. But our current trade agreements, NAFTA, CAFTA, U.S., Colombia, all of these, they set it up exactly that way. Benefits to corporations and really allowing exploitation for workers.
No, but you know, I've been saying for years the whole neoliberal trade agenda has been, you know, set up in a way that, as you've pointed out, that benefits investors and that harms workers at every turn. So I go back to 2016 when Donald Trump's running around saying we're going to renegotiate all this stuff. He didn't mention labor at all in it, but I think a lot of people thought maybe that was part of it. What are your thoughts?
I agree. I think a lot of people thought it was part of it. And hey, here was somebody saying what a lot of workers had been feeling. You've been screwed by rigged trade agreements. He said that. And people said, wait a minute, somebody's finally saying it. They're not messing around by saying, oh, trade is great if we just give you better trade adjustment assistance, or trade's not really bad. It's really the robots that are taking your jobs. You know, he spoke to what a lot of folks felt. Now, the proof will be in the pudding. The NAFTA has currently been noticed for renegotiation. We expect the administration to publish its specific trade negotiating suggestions next week on July 17th, and we will see what is in there. And if it's not strong, enforced labor provisions with timelines and mandatory enforcement, if it's not getting rid of ISDS, if it's not strengthening rules of origin and getting rid of rules that undercut Buy American policies, and if it's not rules that make sure you have to protect the environment, if it's not rules that prevent this race to the bottom in taxes and disinvestment in our own infrastructure, if it's not that, then we know that all that other stuff about trade and was really just another slogan to get elected. And so what this administration puts on the table in NAFTA is really going to matter, and everyone should really pay attention.
Yeah, is there any hope? I mean, honestly and truthfully, I mean, I look at what the Trump administration has done with their Department of Labor so far, and some of just the, you know, the turning back of, you know, of overtime, the gutting of safety precautions and regulations. I mean, is there any hope of actually seeing something positive on the labor front coming out of any renegotiation with NAFTA?
Well, you're exactly right about the new Secretary of Labor and the things coming out of the Labor Department, that it doesn't lead one to be hopeful. I never want to prejudge, but we will say folks should watch. I mean, this administration is so mercurial. It's so unique in that it has this Wall Street wing that wants to do the same old corporate neoliberal, you know, 1% policy, and get away with that. And then there's sort of the proto-fascist, xenophobic, hateful group. And then there seems to be a few folks that, you know, don't fit into either camp and maybe want to do something positive on trade. Will they carry the day? It remains to be seen. But in terms of, you know, what this administration has done so far with rolling back worker protections, folks shouldn't be, you know, wildly optimistic, shall we say.
Yeah, because here's the thing. I mean, you know, with all of this talk, I don't know if you saw during the G20 that, you know, there was talk coming out of that China's taking the lead on free trade, while we're, you know, the message has been that, you know, we're protectionists now, which I disagree with. But, you know, now China's going to be the leader in carrying the free trade mantle. And I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, if the U.S. is protectionist, what are we protecting? We clearly have not been doing a great job of protecting U.S. workers or their wages or their benefits or anything of that nature. You know, protectionism has come to be kind of a silly word that the neoliberals throw at anybody who wants a different trade policy than what they're selling. It doesn't have a lot of substance to it. And, you know, with China leading the so-called free trade, you know, again, what does free trade mean? China doesn't trade freely or fairly. It violates the rules of the World Trade Organization pretty consistently. It engages in illegal subsidization. It has engaged in targeted currency manipulation. It doesn't allow its workers to organize and bargain freely. So it's got all kinds of problems that we would say, well, that's neither free nor fair trade. The problem with the G20 and some of these other international institutions is that they're subject to the same sort of corporate power dynamics as the U.S. economy is right now. And they've almost focused on free trade to the exclusion of all other international economic policies that could actually do a lot more to build growth with equity and shared prosperity and really drive development in a positive way. So where are their discussions about investment in infrastructure? Where are their discussions about doing something serious about tax havens and making sure that countries collect enough tax to go back and invest in their children and invest in their workers and invest in their housing stock and their clean water and on all of these things? So there's too much focus on trade and let's have another new agreement and too little focus on, wait a minute, let's step back and look at what's happening in our economies and figure out how we can create the rules so that working people benefit rather than taking all the risk. Right now, when there's a new trade agreement, who bears the sole risk of what if wages go down and what if I lose my job? It's the worker, and that's a bad model.
I'm right there with you. And the hope is that eventually we come around as a nation to that idea and push in the right direction. Is there any open comment period or anything where people can chime in on this stuff?
The comment period on NAFTA specifically is closed, but there's a new comment period that folks can talk about how trade has hurt them and how the lack of good trade enforcement has specifically hurt them. And if they go to the Federal Register and do a search for USTR and trade enforcement, they can, like, give the administration an earful of exactly what they're thinking.
Well, we will make sure that we look that up and get some of those so people can participate and get their voices heard. Celeste, I appreciate the input, the thoughts. I'm not hopeful, but, you know, maybe there's a possibility that we turn this thing around. Celeste, I appreciate the time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Always great talking with you, Celeste Drake. She's the head honcho there at the Trade and Globalization Policy Specialist with the AFL-CIO. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.